But now here's Bill Resnick with Mark Brenner.
Hi, Mark Brenner. Welcome to KABU.
Oh, Bill, so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Mark Brenner is the director of Labor Notes. Labor Notes is a monthly journal working to put the movement back in the labor movement. Many of you know Labor Notes Network that holds Troublemakers School. There's going to be a Troublemakers School in Portland this coming spring, 2017. They also do the Labor Notes Great National and International Conference. It'll be in spring 2018. It's every 2 years in Chicago. They are wonderful revival meetings, among many other things.
We're trying, Bill. We can't organize fast enough.
Well,
here.
You're from North Carolina. You know how to do a revival.
I've been to tent revivals. Yes, I have.
Mark, you've been watching for, 20, 25 years now, the relentless attack on workers, destruction of labor unions. That's a prime goal of Republicans, often aided by Democrats. Now we have Trump and a Republican Congress and likely a Republican Supreme Court. Law doesn't matter. It's what the Republicans think should be done. First, we need to discuss what they might do, this whole machine, to destroy the labor unions in particular. And then we'll go into what can be done, how the labor movement and progressives in general have actually a great opportunity now to rebuild a fighting left. So, Mark, what might this Republican machine do? What are the near-term struggles?
Well, they've been waiting for a generation for these stars to align to have such a conservative Congress and a president that is certainly not on the same political page as Paul Ryan and many of the other leaders, but is perfectly happy to go along with their agenda. I think that for the labor movement, the probably biggest immediate threat, because it's so easy for this Congress to do, is to pass national right-to-work legislation. We've seen this in the conservative playbook time and again in recent years. Mike Pence, actually in Indiana, was a big proponent of the Indiana right-to-work law. In Michigan, with the fight that we had there. Scott Walker, most famously, in Wisconsin. Every state across the Rust Belt has actually made this a sort of a stump speech promise, every conservative politician, and I think they're going to bring that to Washington and try and spread this. What right to work does, it outlaws the ability for unions to negotiate what we call union security clauses, namely that everybody who works in the workplace is a member of the union, and that is now going to be challenged legally, and it's going to make it a lot harder. Certainly, right to work is not a death sentence for the labor movement. I mean, there are plenty of right to work states where unions are strong, and we see a lot of organizing, like Nevada. You look no further than the culinary workers in Las Vegas, and you can see what is possible in a right to work environment. But unfortunately, we're in a labor movement where too many union leaders are really disconnected and disengaged with their membership. And in that kind of environment, where people see the union as something that is far away from them and doesn't really listen. When you're getting clobbered at work every day, why wouldn't you vote with your feet? So that's the real risk, first and foremost, I think, out of this Congress with this president.
What Right to Work does, though, ultimately, is defund the unions. There's an enormous drop in their dues.
Well, that's the way the Republicans think of it, because they see unions as a political force, right? These are the people who fund the Democrats, who fund our opponents. These are the people who organize the sort of ground game for the Democratic Party, which is absolutely true. There would be no Democratic Party in the Midwest and in many other states if there wasn't the labor movement that we have.
The teachers' unions, in fact, provide nearly everybody at the Democratic National Convention of those 20,000 people.
Labor is absolutely overrepresented in the delegations. There's no question about that. Unlike everywhere else in American life, that's the one place where you see a lot of union members. But it's not just right to work. I mean, that will absolutely be a body blow if they can get it passed, because so many unions are not ready for it. And unfortunately, we kind of had a dress rehearsal for that last year. There was a Supreme Court case that was basically going to do the same thing in the public sector, except for the death of Antonin Scalia. It would have most likely been decided against the labor movement, and it would have created the same division in the public sector unions that right to work creates in the private sector. And most unions sort of treated this like, oh, all we need to do to get ready is we need a better sales pitch, and we need to figure out some tech-savvy ways to collect dues from our members and sign people up on the web. It's a lot bigger than that. People join and stick with unions that are fighting unions. And I think that, unfortunately, too few labor leaders, too few union activists have been able to get that message across. We need to actually be standing up. We need to be active. We need to be visible in the workplace. We need to be fighting back and winning. That's how people are going to stick with the union in a right-to-work environment. If Friedrichs was the dress rehearsal, this court case I was telling you about that failed because of Scalia's death, then I think we've got a lot to worry about. But fortunately, there's a lot more unions that are, I hope, learning that lesson, and we're certainly shouting that from the rooftops. But by no means is right-to-work the only thing we've got to worry about, Bill. Things are going to be a lot tougher before they get better.
Let's talk about that, and let's talk about what a fighting union is, which is really requires a very active, knowledgeable membership. There's lots of resources actually out there, and many unions, in fact, do their best to make sure that they don't have an active membership because those people might want to, in fact, replace the old leadership.
Exactly. Too many labor union leaders are looking over their shoulder, worried about who's the competition, why am I going to develop that steward, why am I going to give them those skills because they might run against me in the next election, real unfortunate mindset.
Yeah, I can't create a fifth column within the union that is ultimately going to consume my position.
Yeah, and this is part of the problem with the fact that too many union leaders look at it exactly like what you said. It's my position. It somehow belongs to me. I got this spot. And I can't underscore enough too, Bill. Remember, at least in the bigger unions, when you get elected to office, you come off the job. You're not working on the hospital floor, the night shift anymore. You're not on the assembly line anymore. You're sitting in the union office. You don't live under the contract you're negotiating. Take Jimmy Hoffa Jr., the head of the Teamsters Union. He doesn't have to see his pension get cut in half like some of the Teamsters in the central part of the country are. And I think that contributes to part of why they hold so dearly onto these positions, because they know that they don't want to go back to work. They don't want to actually punch the clock. They've gotten comfortable. They're making, in some cases, way too much money given what their members are making. And this is fortunately shifting in our direction. This is something Labor Notes has been talking about since our founding in 1979. We see it as a big problem. We've been talking about how to fix it. And I think more and more union activists recognize it and get it and have been trying to steer the ship in a different direction. But there's a lot of unions out there. We still have a lot of work to do to really connect our organizations with the members, to really put them in the driver's seat of our union movement.
It'll be a very tumultuous and difficult, though, transition to that fighting union. And in the short term, I'm hoping that you people are really going to be inspiring, that Labor Notes will inspire that.
We're trying, okay. Bill. But I will say, this is a tough sell. Think about it. Most people who run for union office, even if you run as a reformer, I'm going to, cut salaries. I'm going to be responsive. We have a 24-hour workforce, 24-7 workforce. We're going to have a 24-7 union. All of those promises, all of those pledges that you might make to your membership, members are great. They're like, great, Bill, I'm going to elect you to solve my problems. And then when you go back to them after the election's over and you won and you say, hey, it doesn't work like that. We got to do this together. Most people, they take that as very hard to hear. They're like, nah, I voted for you to fix that problem. I want you to do that, right? And to say this has got to be something that you do, that we do together, that is a much tougher message to get across. But it's the only way forward, Bill.
And it requires a really different consciousness in many ways that can, however, be developed.
Absolutely. We've got a lot of examples, and it's really, I think, quite encouraging times.
Let's talk about some of the examples and how, in fact, the labor movement can reconstruct itself. This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Mark Brenner, who's the director of Labor Notes, a monthly journal putting the movement back in the labor movement. And Labor Notes has Troublemakers School coming up in Portland this spring. They do them all over the country and the national conference in 2018 in Chicago. Mark, let's go to what can be done. You pointed out that there's lots of unions, even in right-to-work states, that are doing quite well, that mobilize their workers. My sense of them is that some of the unions become, in some ways, a secular version of a religious institution, giving people hope, giving people a sense of their capacity, giving people a community to live in, but of course around secular goals of a really much better and democratic life. I mean, that's the kind of union I think that we want.
Bill, you don't have to look any further than the teachers right here in Portland. You remember the big struggle they had a couple years ago with the district over their contract. They were fighting for a vision that inspired the community, and even though they had Democratic Party operatives, they had, you know, hired guns from the Oregonian and from the television stations working for the district, they had million-dollar lawyers on the other side, they still generated a tremendous amount of popular support. And the reason they did it is because they were active and engaged and mobilized, not like a faucet where the leadership turned it on and turned it off. Folks were doing stuff all on their own. And one of the reasons that they did that, Bill, that's really important, is because the union really started with, what do we believe on behalf of our kids? What are we fighting for? And to do that, they also talked about one of the most important union values that we've got, which is an injury to one is an injury to all. And I see that even today in the teachers union here in Portland and many other unions around the country, that if you can build that sort of sense of solidarity, make it a real thing, and really take that out from the union hall to the community, it can be a tremendous force.
Yeah, the teachers' unions that are doing well, like in Chicago, they've all adopted that slogan. Philadelphia and Chicago and Portland students deserve, and we teachers want to build them, and here's how we would do it. It's a wonderful rallying cry. And in fact, they also make the effort. People like their teachers. That's one of the things. Teachers are in contact with parents. One of the strengths of the teachers' union is this enormous community context all the time, particularly in the elementary schools. Other unions don't have, though, that degree of community contact and provide the kinds of service that parents and the whole community so desperately want. But tell us about some other unions that have maintained this very strong activist presence and commitment by their members.
Well, like I said, I think that whether it's hotel workers in Las Vegas or whether it's teachers in Portland, even truck drivers and telephone techs. We just had this huge strike in New York where I live with the Verizon workers. It was actually up and down the East Coast. I don't know if you followed it last spring. But it was a great example of how when unions are organized internally, when members are, you know, clear about what they're doing and they're willing to pick a big fight over something that matters not just to them but to their entire community, they can win. Here you had workers striking against a multi-billion dollar company. Verizon makes $1 billion in profit every month, Bill, and they were coming after a generation's worth of healthcare benefits and wages and pensions. And these workers said, how in the world can you be one of the richest companies in our country and not treat us fairly? And they were willing to stand on the picket lines for almost a month and some change to do that. And they won. They won against all the odds. I never would have predicted that they could be beat Verizon hands down, but they did.
You know, that sort of fairness motive, the fairness demand, it's very, very powerful. And we saw it, in fact, in this last election. I mean, Trump won. But in fact, if you look at the larger picture of the election, it was an enormous populist eruption from working people, basically. Part of it, of course, was rightist and contributed to Trump's victory. But the Bernie Sanders campaign almost upended and would have if it weren't for all of the various dirty tricks that the Clinton camp was able to successfully do. It seems to me there's really, within the sort of the working class of this country, there's the opportunity for actually reconstructing a progressive movement.
I couldn't agree with you more, Bill. I mean, I look at the Bernie Sanders campaign with so much admiration and inspiration because, you know, I've known Bernie Sanders. He's a Labor Notes subscriber. He's spoken at our events. He's been around much longer than, you know, this election would lead you to believe, obviously, as a senator, but as a movement person. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating about it, one of the things that I think progressives sometimes don't even believe in their own heart, is that most people agree with us. They agree that bankers and billionaires and corporate CEOs and the politicians that are bought and paid for by these folks shouldn't be in charge of our country, that we live in the richest country in the history of humanity. Why can't everybody have health care? Why can't we have the best schools on the planet? Why can't we actually tackle big problems like climate change? I mean, look, if we could put a man on the moon, how is it that we can't figure out how to put solar panels on every public building in America? These are the kind of questions that Sanders was asking, and the fact that he was raising our expectations, that he was asking us to aim higher, was really, I think it spoke to a hunger that's out there that I think we can tap, both in the labor movement, because certainly he had tremendous support among unionists. Union activists were turning out in droves to be part of his campaign in ways that I have not seen in my 20 plus years in the labor movement, and in the general population, especially among young folks, which I think is even more encouraging.
And especially, it seems to me, in, quote, the blue states, there are tremendous opportunities now to secede. You know about secession in North Carolina. Well, we can't secede from the United States, but we can secede from the policy directions on a state level. It seems to me there are tremendous opportunities now for raising the minimum wage, for changing all sorts of work rules, for empowering working people, for dealing with climate change and health care at a state level. For every dollar that Trump gives to his rich 1%, states can tax it, raise their income taxes to meet on the same groups that got the gain, which will be a tremendous amount of resources that can actually go for good things. There are real opportunities, especially there and even at the legislative level. I mean, that's one part of it. Why don't you sum up, Mark?
Well, I think two things are really, really key here, Bill. One is that we have to actually act, right? And for the labor movement, for unions, first thing we've got to do is get our own house in order. Members have been too far removed, too disengaged for far too long. And if we don't actually recruit exponentially more leaders in this effort of ours, it's really still going to remain the kind of astroturf politics that we've seen coming out of this elite political class that runs the Democratic Party. And I think that for us as a union movement, I think there's some other really important things that we need to do aside from, you know, pushing very aggressively the kinds of audacious policy measures that you're talking about. We also negotiate contracts with thousands of employers around the country. I believe every union in America should be actually pushing contract language across the table that protects workers based on their immigration status, that allows for religious expression. These are things that matter a lot for immigrant members, for Muslim union members, but they also send a really powerful signal of solidarity. Like, we are not going to stand by while people target our communities, target people in our organizations. An injury to one is an injury to all. And these things can be incredibly powerful. Like the Fight for 15 movement, most people don't actually really realize one of the key moments in that fight, long before they actually won a $15 minimum wage at the SeaTac airport, which was really one of the first. Seattle airport, you know, campaign was really the beginning of the spread of the $15 an hour campaign from Seattle everywhere. But one of the precursors to that was organizing car rental workers, many of whom were Somali Muslims, who were being targeted by their employer because they wanted to take their prayer breaks. And there was a lot of actual harassment. And the union organized, I mean, it was actually led by a community organization. And then the union recognized that it needed to get on board and actually embrace this sort of fight for freedom of religious expression. And those folks became some of the real partisans of this campaign. And that's exactly the kind of spirit that we need to take first inside of our union and then outside. Like, we need to be the anchor of rapid response networks that are defending immigrant workers targeted by a Trump administration who's promised to deport 3 million people. We need to be there when Muslim communities are being targeted. We need to be the anchor of all of those defense efforts. But I can't leave without saying one thing about the party and the election that you brought up that I just want to put a real important point on. Labor has spent billions of dollars over the years on elections and Democratic Party campaigns and candidates, and we have a very precious little to show for it. I think one of the things that we cannot do is let this election pass without a thoroughgoing examination of what happened. I always come back to this town hall meeting I watched on C-SPAN once where Arlen Specter, a Republican who turned independent, was talking to people in his district about what was the proposal for what is now Obamacare. And one of his constituents just was outraged and was yelling at him. And he was like, you and the people up there in Washington, you're going to do what you want to do and what the people who pay you want you to do. You don't care about us. And it was this incredibly visceral expression of the alienation that most folks have from the political parties, from the political professionals. And I think this election was an incredible rejection in both parties of that establishment, that elite. And I think that the Bernie Sanders campaign was another expression of that. And I think that there's a tremendous, as we were saying before, tremendously fertile ground for a different kind of politics that is much more rooted in working class values, in an ambitious vision of what this country could be. And if we miss the opportunity to steer our forces and our efforts in that direction, shame on us. Another thing we have to actually do, Bill, is we have to, in terms of bringing our members into the union and making them really feel like they're in the driver's seat, is we can't ignore the elephant in the room. Hillary Clinton got the lowest percentage of votes from union households since 1980, and a lot of union members, 43% nationally and a majority in swing states like Ohio, voted for Trump. And I think that we need to actually have a lot of conversations, sometimes very uncomfortable ones, about why that is. And we can't whitewash what's been going on in our country, and we can't ignore the racism and xenophobia and sexism of the Trump campaign. But we also, at our peril, ignore a huge chunk of our membership. And if you couldn't figure out a way to build a real base of solidarity around values like an injury to one is an injury to all, and really help people understand and engage with the issues like police violence, with what Trump is really going to do to our brothers and sisters who maybe don't have documentation, or to our Muslim brothers and sisters. If you can't do that inside of an organization like our unions, I don't know where you can do it. But I think another reason we have to do that is because these are the folks who are the base for this disaffected vote against the people who run everything. And that's who they are.
A lot of people are angry at sort of the white now, see the white working class as completely infected by this racism and misogyny, including, in fact, some of the women within those apparatuses. They're shocked by it, and they see it just as an expression of this primitive sort of racism and sexism. And
I've seen a lot of those same stories, Bill. I've heard a lot of people try and explain this as a vote for racism, as a sort of simple, clear expression of the racism of the white working class. And I'm sorry, I don't think it's that simple. When you have Barack Obama, the man whose middle name is Hussein, winning Youngstown, Ohio, part of this long-standing, unionized, blue-collar white working class by 22 points.
Yeah, counties all over the Rust Belt who voted for Obama twice and now voted for Trump. That's very... Explain the significance of that.
Well, it's what we were saying earlier, that this is it's not simply a vote for a guy who expresses white pride. I think that for a lot of people, unpacking what it means, what is racism and xenophobia really are, and actually getting folks to confront that is going to be, as I said, a challenge. We've got to do that with a lot of uncomfortable conversations. But I think that just saying that's what folks were voting for, misinterprets what's happening in these communities, and it misinterprets a lot of this election, because as strong, I believe, was this rejection of class, of political operatives and professionals that are running both parties. And there's this profound sense of alienation that people have from not just D.C., like them, but the whole process. I mean, hell, let's not forget, half the country didn't vote. Those folks are also part of this alienated block that we need to be talking about. Why is it that people don't think that whatever happens with this election, it's going to have any benefit for them? Because more often than not, that's exactly what happened.
A lot of that's rage, is the rage of what's happened to their lives and become so much more precarious, seeing their kids not being able to afford their education or even get a decent job, seeing their own retirement benefits depleting, and seeing their communities getting destroyed.
Right. When you've had a wrecking ball swinging through your community for 3 decades and Hillary Clinton shows up and wants to talk about tweaking earned income tax credit, that is not an appeal to you as a voter. This is a five-alarm fire in your neighborhood, and folks are rolling up with very milquetoast solutions to the dire problems that you find yourself in. And I think that's part of what is exciting to me about, or was exciting to me about the Sanders campaign, was I believe that Sanders very clearly recognized that people who are in this kind of crisis need ambitious solutions to very deep problems. They don't need milquetoast. They need something much stronger. And he offered that to them, and I think they turned out in droves for that. And I think the labor movement, I think the progressives more generally, should take that lesson very strongly to heart.
Mark Brenner, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Always great to be at KBOO.
It was a great revival meeting here at KBOO at 9 o'clock here, pre-recording Thursday, November 17th.
Always glad to be here, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Very good talking to you. Thanks.
You too.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland.